Okay, Mort Kondracki, then David Brooks, and then Knapp. But Mort, over here.
So you tossed off this reference to the strong man as something that was in our future, and I fear that it is in our immediate future. And I wanted you to expand on that a little bit. But my theory about this is the big sort, that what's happened in America is that religious people have gone off into their sphere. They go to their churches. They go to their they watch Fox News, or they vote Republican. They avoid the elites. They oppose same-sex marriage strongly. They shout about it. Whereas the seculars inhabit the city and the university for sure, and say things like, those poor people, all they do is they cling to their guns and their religion. President Obama, he would be, one of the elites, although he claimed, never mind. So what I see is not this, what you call, no turning back. I see an attempt to turn back, a division in the society, a polarization politically and religiously. And in this confusion and in the sort of expressions of rage which are constantly being drummed along by activist groups and radio talk show hosts and cable channels and stuff like that, a war going on. And into this war steps somebody saying, follow me, I can solve it all, I'll fix it, I'll make America great again. And I think that there's actually a kind of a strange religious component to this of, I'll make it all the way it was back in the 50s. We're gonna call it Merry Christmas again, right? That's a message that I think differs from what you're hopefully saying about the sort of the acceptance of secularity.
Yeah, and I don't want to pretend I'm not a pundit and a political commentator.
Well, go ahead.
I think so I guess part of what, and even you, the conversations with you today, I mean, this is such a learning experience for me. Part of what I now wish I knew more about were the dynamics of what we could call the secularization of the working class, right? Because that now all of a sudden I'm really, really interested in that. My hunch is that actually the engine of secularization here is more Walmart than NYU. And by that I mean that the sort of force of cultural liturgies of consumerism and consumption and finding meaning in a kind of economic expression, which has been powerfully, I think, formative over the last generation or two, not because the mall convinced us of anything, but because it subtly co-opted us by its liturgies. If then people effectively are secularized insofar as they've given themselves to the realities of the market and consumption is the way that they're going to be happy, then you are going to experience the failures of the market to deliver in ways that have almost a kind of religious crisis about them, right? And so now what you're looking for is somebody to pull the levers to make that system generate what it promised for you. Now, I think there's all kinds of just sheer, straight up xenophobia that's at work here. The other thing that struck me, and this is totally now me as an amateur pundit, I wonder to what extent this dynamic is the reality of people who find themselves just a million miles from political power and the machinations of political power. So government has always just been some sort of distant magic. And so now you're just looking for your magician. Do you know what I mean? You're just looking for the guy who promises to make that magic work for you. I think that itself is a sign of a disenfranchisement and a disenchantment. Yeah, I don't have any answers. I'm just totally thinking alongside with you. And I could see how clearly some are capitalizing on this campaign on a attempt to roll back secularity three. To me, that is just unconstructive resentment. But apparently it works. So that's the disturbing, and that's why I'm trying to think through, is the way to understand this to tap into it as a kind of religious dynamic, right? A kind of religious response. I'm not sure. Yeah.
Quickly on this point, Naomi, 30 seconds, and then David Brooks is next.
I wonder whether there is a connection here. The economic forces didn't pop up suddenly, but what we have seen is the moving away of these institutions, that used to connect people to those centers of power, whether it was political parties or churches, and all of that, this connection is working at the same time and forcing maybe people, making people feel like their hands have been forced into this.
Yeah, so a sort of Robert Putnam analysis alongside this, right? Yeah, very good, very helpful.
Okay, David Brooks and then Knapp.
So you mentioned that Taylor's praises secularism the last 500 years for creating, its great achievement is to create a purely humanistic account of what a meaningful life looks like. And then you went on to describe the supernova, the cross-pressured individual, and then you described some beautiful examples of this person, and whether it's Julian Barnes or David Foster Wallace or Terrence Malick or Steve Jobs or even Trump supporters, I guess, they don't seem complete. They don't seem to have an example of a purely humanistic account of a meaningful life. And so, do you have any good examples of people who have achieved this?
Well, they would be saints, right?
But they're haunted by Godism in almost every case, whether it's Jobs' 50-50 or Barnes or Wallace.
How about Dorothy Day? I'm just going through chapters in your book now, right? but wouldn't Dorothy Day be just a fantastic illustration of also somebody who clearly inhabited the cross-pressured space, right? So it's not like she was living in some naive la-la land where she was protected from that. I mean, I think of actually Ely's book, the four of them, right? O'Connor, Percy, Day and Merton, right?
Yep.
To me, all four of those are just such compelling stories.
Say the title of that book again.
The Life You Save Might Be Your Own, is that it?
Say it again.
Paul Ely, The Life You Save Might Be Your Own.
Yeah.
And it's sort of like these four biographies of Catholic artists, novelists, and so on. And to me, yeah, I guess I keep looking at examples like that of people who have felt the cross pressure, walk through it. Taylor actually thinks Gerard Manley Hopkins is another example. Ivan Illich, these folks who have felt honestly and traumatically even the failures of sort of modern promises, but haven't then just retreated in repristinating ways, but have sort of forged new paths. That's why he ends A Secular Age by saying, look, it's the poets that are sort of, it's working at the level of the imagination that helps us see a future. So does that, yeah?
And we've wound up at Dorothy Day, we haven't moved very far.
In the sense that it's a recovery, you mean? Or?
I mean, most secular people would not say Dorothy Day is a secular person.
Ah, well, but she's secular in the third sense, right? It's interesting. Nancy Murphy taught for a long time at Fuller Seminary. She used to talk about what she called the omega shape of history, which was, you had this sort of ancient medieval kind of worldview, plausibility structures. You have some of the revolutions of modernity that set us out on this detour. And then what it turns out is, in post-modernity, you come back to a place that actually has a remarkable amount of continuity with what had gone before. And this turns out to be this sort of detour that we went through. You can't forget it, but you're in a different space. And I think that's, there's always going to be something strange, right? There's always going to be an element of memory, I guess, to this. Sometimes I like it when Taylor says, tell me what you think about St. Francis, right? And I'll tell you what your sort of basement assumptions are. If you think St. Francis basically chose to live a deformed life, I already know what you believe. But if you think St. Francis is an icon of flourishing, then you've got a totally different account of what it is to flourish. I think it's always going to be that competition between the two. Yeah.
Excellent. Nap Nasworth, and then Abdullah over here.
I want to talk about evangelicals. You were talking about the two trajectories, and for the second trajectory, the non-mainline Protestant one, you said non-denominational congregations are retrieving ancient ways of being Christian. So I have three questions about that. Can you give some specific examples of how they're doing that? And how does that tie into sector three? And then also, are these congregations that you're talking about, is it related to any other things like urban versus rural, small church, big church, mega church, multiracial, multi-ethnic churches versus mostly white churches? What are you seeing?
Yeah, great questions. So I should probably flag this by saying I'm probably seeing a self-selecting sample because this is people who are inviting me places. So, because in some ways I would say I'm a Protestant evangelical who sees his mission as to remind evangelicals that they're Catholic, right? In the sense that I think the only small C Catholic, sure. I want to say big C Catholic, but not necessarily Roman, okay? I believe in the Holy Catholic Church. And what I mean by that is helping, it seems to me the viability of faith communities in a secular three age are directly indexed to their ability to draw on wells that are older than modernity, right? So that in fact, it's not just a nostalgic retrieval, but it is basically finding ways of being faithful in the present that draw on and are tied to ancient and medieval ways that the Spirit has led throughout the ages. That's kind of what I mean by Catholicity. And I just see a remarkable and surprising openness to this in places that you would never expect. I have another book called Desiring the Kingdom, which is kind of the academic version of You Are What You Love, which is kind of making this case. And I get calls from places like Dallas Theological Seminary. Do any of you know Dallas Seminary? It's kind of like the heart of dispensationalist evangelicalism. And they're reading this stuff, which is talking about ancient liturgies and St. Augustine and all these kinds of things. So two congregations come to mind. One is Christ Community Church in Des Moines, Iowa, which started as a plant of a massive Baptist megachurch in the city, sort of went out into this very intentional liturgical, sacramental, Catholic, almost monastic expression. Ironically, when they then looked around and realized if we were really consistent with this, we shouldn't be independent, right? We should be woven into the web of some sort of body and community. They actually ended up joining the Mennonite Church. So they're kind of sacramental Mennonites, which is basically Stanley Hauerwas. It's a Stanley Hauerwas congregation. So that's in Des Moines. So I don't know, how do you want to characterize that? It's urban, but it also has a kind of, it's definitely Midwestern sort of thing. We could talk about a bunch of congregations in Brooklyn that are associated with the Presbyterian Church in America, the Resurrection Network of Churches, that also are sort of tapping into this liturgical, ancient, sacramental heritage. In a way, you could say it's a re-enchanted Christianity. And then a place like Sojourn, which is a non-denominational church in Louisville, Kentucky. What's going on here is everybody, I would say, is waking up to the dynamics that David and James are going to talk about, which is the dynamics of formation and character. And they're realizing that worship is sort of the incubator for the formation of Christian character, right? And so they have to become more intentional about what worship looks like, and that looks like retrieving ancient forms. So there's an interesting, I think it's consistent with the secular three reality. Maybe it actually comes back to Benedict option kind of stuff, because it's saying, we sort of we have underestimated the power of formation of cultural liturgies, and we've left the treasures of cultural formation in our own religious tradition off the table. In fact, what we did was we took the cultural liturgies and we thought we could make church cool, because we'd make it like the mall or the rock concert or the coffee shop, and then that turns out to be a dynamics of assimilation. The ethnic piece of that, I'm not sure I would have any confident assessment of that. I would say, like a place like Sojourn, I know it is not just an elite educated class kind of dynamic. That's quite a working class congregation. I'd have to do more digging around to know that. How are they changing their worship service? Basically, they're going from what I call the sort of talking head brain on a stick model, where you walk in, sing 30 minutes of very emotive songs, and then sit down for a 45-minute lecture, to what I think most people would feel like is a kind of Catholic rhythm, right? They see worship as this narrative performance from beginning to end, and they're sort of walking through the dynamics of, you know, confession, absolution. Here's an untold story, I think. I don't know what counts for journalists, but to me it's fascinating how many Presbyterian churches now observe weekly Eucharist or communion. So to me that's always just a little signal. Whenever you run into evangelical churches that are practicing weekly communion or Lord's Supper, what's happened is they have effectively appropriated a Catholic cadence, right? And they have to be very intentional about it, because everybody's like, oh, we're not supposed to do it every week, it won't be special anymore or whatever, right? And there's just a lot of, and that's both kind of evangelical denominational realities, like these Presbyterian churches I mentioned, but also a bunch of these non-denominational churches. So does that feel like something interesting? I don't know. I just think it's an interesting bellwether of actually kind of contemporary congregations looking for the resources of ancient formative practices. That's the way I would narrate it.
Okay, Abdullah, pull the mic over, and then Jessica Stern.
Thank you, David. Fascinating conversation. Two questions. If one can simplistically talk, there are two schools of thoughts in secularism. And I feel you are too Anglo-Saxon school of secularism centric. And there's a French secularism, which I grew up in Turkey with. It's not disbelief, but it's grudgingly accepting religion is not going to disappear, but we have to control it. We have to almost treating religion like a herpes. It's not going to go away. So at the
prophylactics.
Yes, exactly. to me, most people are in different proportions both. There's a hybrid secularism that some people are Anglo-Saxon type secularism to their own faith tradition but towards other faith traditions they become immediately French type of secularism. Ted Cruz, when he's advocating for people to pray when people ask, can Muslims pray? Can Jews pray? Can Hindus pray? He become incredibly French secularist, saying that's absolutely not the case. So there is so much hybrid, and people are not one kind. Even like many Christians who are secular in an Anglo-Saxon type, they are comfortable with it if the religion is remaining within the four walls of church, especially Episcopalians. They don't know what to do if that goes beyond the four walls of church, etc. So I feel your conversations are too Anglo-Saxon type centric. The second, also as you beautifully discussed the social manifestation of these intellectual and religious sort of shifts and patterns in our society, it's again too liberal Protestant centric. What those conversations and patterns that you discuss means in the face of this major demographic changes happening in American society. What does those conversations mean for practicing Catholics, Muslims, Jews, who are not really like that?
That's great. The first analysis is brilliant. So in what way my account is too Anglo-Saxon in the sense that I'm too comfortable with? Can you just say a little bit more about that so I know how to engage? What you define the French very, very well. I'm never going to forget religion is herpes. But what characterizes the Anglo-Saxon as you're describing it?
Anglo-Saxon secularism It divides the religion as separation of church and state, but it respects religion. There is no innate hostility towards religion. It respects religion, which I believe is like a John Adams type secularism. It's what America mainly built upon, but in their personal life. But French secularism is innately hostile towards religion.
It sort of considers
religion, again, something to be afraid of and to be limited.
Yes. And would you say, I just think that's very helpful. Would you say, is there a legitimate worry that certain kind of elite sectors in the United States tend towards the French?
Yes.
And which is then also breeds its own resentment from those religious communities.
Absolutely.
Yeah. That's a great point. I don't have anything to really add to that than others saying, I guess the way I would push back on the French sort of revolutionary model is to point out something like Tom was saying, that actually then what happens is you actually make secularism its own kind of, it's religion-like at least, right? It's sort of, and that's where then I want to sort of unleash the epistemological dogs and call into question what underwrites that kind of confidence. It's really helpful. The liberal Protestant centric, that's me trying to stick to what I know. Right, so I would love to hear more about how other religious traditions see themselves navigating. Like for example, could Muslim communities accept something like this secularity three analysis? In other words, is something like the analysis available more broadly? But then we would have to think differently about the resources. I would love to hear more.
The Anglo-Saxon type of secularism is the ideal model. Most Muslims coming to the United States, they come with incredible attraction and appeal to Anglo-Saxon secularism because many of them are suffering with French type secularism. Many countries like Tunis, Turkey, they learned from the French teachers and they even mastered further in their understanding. Despite post-9/11 realities, many American Muslims feel they practice their religion more comfortably in America than anywhere else. But those parameters have not been developed yet.
Yeah, no, that's very helpful. I mean, it does strike me that then there's probably an interesting conversation to be had about U.S. history in that regard, given early commerce between France and the United States in some of the ideology of this, as opposed to, again, this work by Joan Lockwood O'Donovan on England and the way in which actually the establishment of the church was good for religious minorities. And actually religious minorities, non-Christian minorities, have been some of the strongest opponents of the disestablishment of the church. That would be an illustration of this Anglo-Saxon model. Yeah, that's really helpful. That's great. Thank you.
Okay, Professor Jessica Stern is up next, over here.
Thank you so much. As I said to you, I think this is both educational and incredibly moving, and I'm really grateful to you.
Thank you.
I am wondering whether the pressure for secularity three results in part from the declining percentage of Christians in the United States and Canada. I was looking at the Pew polls. Mm-hmm. You know, we keep talking about what's happening in the United States, who's less religious, who's more. The latest Pew poll shows that between 2007 and 2014, religiously affiliated persons went down somewhat from 83% to 77%. So there's a slight decline, not that it's secularism, but there is nonetheless a slight decline. And the group most responsible for the decline, at least according to this poll, is millennials. It's not working class, although I've seen that some sociologists claim that working class people are leaving the church. And it brings me to a question that of course is related to my own obsessions, but just kept coming up for me while I heard you speaking. The universalist impulse in religion versus the particularist. How do you encourage a thick version of secularity three while perhaps discouraging that particularist impulse such that it doesn't become a majoritarian rule, such that only Christians feel at home?
Yeah, this is great. I'm learning so much. This is so helpful.
Well, you think of your answer. Let me. I heard the other day a wonderful comment. Somebody said the problem with theocracy is everybody wants to be Theo.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, on the first point, I think what's interesting is the sort of Pew demographic snapshot. I would say is not a sign that we are arriving at secularity III. It is a set of shifts taking place within secularity III that has been a reality for a long time, right? Now, you could grant that the speed with which secularity III seeps into the social imaginary of a society, as Taylor puts it, has been slower in the United States than in continental Europe or in the United Kingdom or something like that. I think that's probably true. But what's interesting is the demographic story is, it's hard to know whether it's cause or effect, right? Or whether it's, I think it's more symptomatic of things that have already taken place. I do think the reality of immigration is precisely what is ramping up the learning curve for US society in appreciating this, right? And in Canada too. Because, and it's interesting, Taylor talks about one of the features of belief in a secular age, when you feel this cross pressure, is he talks about it as the fragilization of belief, right? And that's this sense in which, in a way, you can't just naively and confidently assume your way of seeing the world is the only way of seeing the world. And I think the realities of immigration bring the world's religions and beliefs home or here. And so people are obviously, it's just like their education ramps up exponentially in appreciating that dynamic, which is then also, I think, you get some of the resentment kind of movements, and you can get steam behind the kind of repristination dynamics. The universalist particulars, that's really interesting. I've been wondering lately, so generally I'm suspicious of talking about religion. Do you know what I mean? I'm not sure that there's, I understand it works as a certain shorthand to get at some phenomena, but I think usually all we ever have are religions. And it seems to me some religions, oh gosh, I don't, am I gonna regret? I'm just gonna say, it seems to me some expressions of religions have internal to them an account of why believers ought to be universalist. That is not universal across all of those religions, right? So I don't want to have to pick between universalism versus particularism, right? I think you could make a case that in some ways fostering, again, this might be a kind of Benedict option logic, but fostering a deep catechesis in a particular religion is precisely how you foster a people who make room for a pluralistic public sphere. I don't know.
Yeah?
Does that make sense? I don't know. Yeah, it's a great theme to think about.
Okay, Kathleen Parker and then Daniel. And then, yeah.
Hi, over here.
Oh, you gotta turn the button on.
There we go. First of all, I apologize for dragging the conversation from the sublime to the mundane, but and this question may have come up. You may have discussed this in my absence, so please just stop me if that's the case. But I was just wondering if I would just be interested in your thoughts about the evangelical support for Donald Trump.
Yeah.
You know, I'm sure there are other issues. You know, evangelicals aren't only evangelicals, but there are, and other issues may be more important than their religious beliefs. But, you know, when Donald Trump says he's a Christian and he doesn't need forgiveness and he is otherwise as unchristian-like as anyone we've ever seen. Do you have any theories on what they're attracted to or some other explanation for this odd support?
Yeah, so I have two. And again, I'm not a sociologist, so I'm a philosopher. I'm just a poor country philosopher. Two things. One is a spectacular failure of catechesis. Do you know what I mean? Like, it's just, because either way, I will say on Super Tuesday, as I was watching some data come in, it turned out that there was also, I think 35% of Catholics also voted for Trump. So I felt at least a little bit of relief because it's not only our problem. But it strikes me that what we're dealing with here, and this is something Tom's story on NPR covered, is the extent to which evangelical has just been an identifier, like a descriptor that people put on themselves, a label that they wear, and insofar as that's coupled with a spectacular failure of catechesis, that by that I mean like actual instruction in the faith, people can almost fill that descriptor with whatever they think is a certain badge. And so when you ask them, are you X? Yes, I'm an evangelical. Do you support Donald Trump? Yes, I do. There's not much experience tension.
Well, then let's just make
those.
It Christians across the board rather than evangelical as some
would,
special
And would brand. That change the data, though? I wonder. Because, yeah. I feel like the other piece that I'm interested in is, it relates to this theme of excarnation that I was talking about. So, and this is a more volatile hypothesis. But my sense is, or my hunch, is that evangelicalism as a form of Protestantism is susceptible to turning Christianity into a web of beliefs to which you assent, which then doesn't necessarily have to come with a ton of connection to a way of life that you practice. So you get this really, this was never supposed to happen, but you get nominal evangelicals. Whereas most people became evangelicals because they were nominal Lutherans or whatever. Do you know what I mean? There's something weird. And particularly in regions like the South and so on, this worked. This is why I think I don't want to just, if our polling or our social science could be much more fine-grained and not just ask the self-descriptor question, but if, as again, Tom's story, if you dig down to the level of practice and participation, yes. I think you see very different numbers about Trump, for example. I think that probably also explains that Massachusetts number, because if you're Irish in South Boston, you're a Catholic. Of course you are, even though you've never been to church in years, right? So there's affiliation as opposed to practice, I think, is really crucial.
And the data is in on that, Jamie.
Okay.
When you hold for people who go to church at least once a week, maybe twice, but once, the numbers for Trump go way down. And I always thought, and I've said this to John Green, who's been here before, who's a political scientist and demographer, that I thought that was a description of evangelical, a person who actually
goes to church a lot.
And says that to be an evangelical means to be a faithful participant in not only church, but Wednesday night Bible studies. And so then, therefore, when I've had calls on this question, and the word evangelical has become so flimsily described that in South Carolina, somebody says, well, you must be an evangelical. Yeah, I think so. I go to church once a year during Easter.
Yeah.
Well, that's not an evangelical.
In South Carolina, they say they're more evangelicals than people.
I would also add one related to something we were talking about earlier in response to Knapp. So one of the other things that intrigues me is when evangelical Protestants start kind of embracing this Catholicity account, I would say baked into the DNA of that expression and formation of Christianity is something that weds you to a people, right, that's transnational and ancient. So it undercuts nationalism. Whereas the other sort of intellectualized, you know, Christianity for brains on a stick, I think is also the most susceptible to being just co-opted by nationalisms. And so that might also explain some of the Trump phenomenon, maybe a little bit of Ted Cruz phenomenon too, though.
Just on this point, Jessica, and then Daniel, you're up next.
I wonder whether your concept of the liturgy of the mall helps to explain that. And maybe if there's time, I think you are brilliant on that topic. I hope you'll get to it.
Oh, yeah, I don't know if we will. I do this in You Are What You Love. In other words, one of the things that I've been trying to push, in a way, this is a different way of thinking about religion, not as a constellation of beliefs, doctrines, and ideas, but actually as a formative way of life, right? It's something that's practiced, the primacy of practice. But if once you start looking at religion in that way, what you'll also realize is that the competing religions aren't just the things that call themselves religions, right? It's actually the liturgies of consumerism and the cathedrals of consumerism, the mall or whatever it might be, are as powerfully co-optive as rival gospels or messages or religions. And I think, to me, a lot of the explanatory dynamic for, say, Protestant evangelical assimilation to wider cultural dynamics is not that somebody changed their mind, it's that somebody trained their hearts, right? Like, and they were co-opted by these rival liturgies. And which then is what catalyzes new intentionality about Christian liturgical formation as a countermeasure to that. Yeah.
Okay, Daniel, pull the mic over. Daniel, and then Wahaj, you're next.
So thank you so much. I had a two-part question. How would you address the responsibility of evangelicals or just Christians in general, Protestants or Catholics, for secularists have kind of split themselves away from people who are religious in America, where they think, oh, those people are crazy, we don't associate with, it's the big sort theory. What's the responsibility of evangelicals for doing their own splitting, where they feel like those city slickers, they don't feel an attachment as it's like two different countries? And how, do you think that's going to continue? And the second part of my question is, you've talked about how secularism has hurt the country a little bit in that it, just in all the ways you talked about that, what can be done to keep America a democracy, but bring, dial back some of the secularism so that people have, what's the practical things? Can be done to address this, but still keep, not return back to where religion is everything.
Yeah, yeah. No, it's great. Thank you. On the first point, to be perfectly honest, I think it's way harder and almost impossible for religious people to insulate themselves from secularism in this society than it is for quote-unquote secular elites to ensconce themselves without ever having to bump into religious people. Because, for reasons like James was mentioning, in a way, the symbolic universes, the cultural systems are kind of hooked up to... as soon as you have cable, fundamentalism is dead. Do you know what I mean? There's no whence our resistance, I think the story. No, you're right, absolutely, but in some ways, I'm not condoning it. I'm just saying you can also understand some of the feeling of stuff kind of being crammed down throats. Do you know what I mean? For us raising four kids, you're working on all these kinds of intentional measures, not to cocoon them, but to be intentional about their formation. And there's just all this kind of competition. So you can see how they feel like it's not a fair game, right? That Goliath gets to pull the strings of society. The second question I think is really interesting. Academics are the worst because I keep thinking of these books that are not popular, but Jeffrey Stout at Princeton. Does anybody know that name? Jeffrey Stout is somebody, actually, he'd be a fascinating figure to bring here. He's in the religion department at Princeton University, wrote a book called Democracy and Tradition. So Stout takes himself to be an Emersonian, right? He has no kind of traditional religious affiliation at all, but is an ardent critic of secularism in the way that I've been describing it. And I think at the end of it, and yet he's also critical of people like Stanley Hauerwas and Benedict Option people, because he thinks it sounds like he's giving them license to no longer participate in the public sphere and the common good. So he's like, no, we need religious folks to participate in our democracy for the good of our democracy. I would say the one move that I find interesting here is to stop focusing on federal politics And so what's interesting is he frames this as, what does it look like for religious folk, let's say, to get involved and engaged in municipal politics, neighborhood politics, state politics, right? Like taking seriously in some ways the layers of the republic. Because by the time you get to federal politics, it's just such a train wreck and gridlock. Whereas there's meaningful, you know, what a mayor and city council can do can be pretty powerful in shaping the way people live lives in a city. And so encouraging that lower level of democratic participation, this is another reason why, though, I'm really interested in the work of Oliver O'Donovan, because he basically shows how and why Christians, for example, should be invested in democracy, because in some ways it owes its legacy to these religious traditions. So there's a genealogy story to tell where we shouldn't have to choose between the two, I think. Yeah.
Okay, Wahaj.
Good morning, everyone. I was unable to meet most of you last night. I'm here as the unofficial ambassador of moderate Muslims everywhere. Myself and Abdullah are the last moderate Muslims on earth. So we're unicorns. That's on the record, by the way. Thank you for understanding that joke. Hip crowd. Speaking about religious minorities, I know we touched upon it, and using the definitions we've discussed about secularity, secularism, and I would say even a type of fundamentalism, either religious fundamentalism or even the type of personality I think that Morton was describing, I think you could say the Trump voter that has emerged that wants things to go back to the way they were,
yeah.
Black and white television,
yeah.
Where things were simple.
Yes.
And people like me didn't exist with
yes.
these difficult names.
Totally.
I know, these multi-hyphenated names, two skin colors, not caramel mocha.
Yeah.
You know, I'm sitting here thinking about this in modern America, the existence of religious minorities. Now, we can talk about Muslims because they seem to be animating most of this discussion. We can talk about Jews, Hindus, Buddhists. Is the existence of religious minorities in America, not just the existence, but the, if you will, the swagger, the prominence, the emergence of religious minorities in America, ironically fueling not only secularism, as manifested by the new atheist, also secularity, and also religious fundamentalism? And if it is, then what does that say about the role and place of religious minorities for the future of America? I want your thoughts on that.
No. So I'm immediately going to Abdullah's frame in that it would fuel secularism if the secularism was this kind of French model, and it worries, and it first of all, probably doesn't have any grain of nuance in what it thinks it's seeing in religious communities.
Repeat again what the French model is.
The religion is herpes. How can you forget that? Right?
I just wanted to hear it again.
Yeah. I could see that. It would absolutely contribute to Secularity 3 as well. What I would say is contribute to an awareness of it. Like, it's sort of like wake up and smell Secularity 3, because obviously we live in a more contested and diverse space. Now, for somebody who sees Secularity 3 as actually a healthy environment for religious communities to be who they are called to be, I welcome that, right? Like, that seems like a good. But I can clearly see why it also then becomes this catalyst for resentment. And by resentment, I also mean kind of a retrenchment back to this myth. And that's the turning back the clock thing, which I just think is characterized by a kind of, I was going to say ignorance, but what do you say?
Naivete.
Naivete. Yeah. It's a naivete.
That's a nice way of saying ignorance.
But yeah. I guess what's worrisome, though, is how much energy that seems to be able to generate, right? Like, that's still tapping into something here. Go ahead.
I mean, and specifically, the one community then I don't think we discuss is then when you look at religious communities, like evangelical communities, for example,
yeah.
whether or not they're real evangelicals who go to church or the ones who are just by virtue of checking on the box for, like, the Trump voter. I'm being simplistic now. I'm really curious because if you see the communities themselves, the traditions, the values, very similar. Oftentimes, which might be seen as an anathema to some people. What? Muslims have similar values to evangelicals and Christians.
Yeah.
I went to all-boys Jesuit Catholic high
school. Yeah.
Where I dominated every semester when it came to religious studies, by the way, which made my priest like weep every day.
Yes.
But the stories were very same. It was like, you know, yes, we studied the Bible as a literature, traditional values. And what's interesting to me is I agree with you then the secularism aspect of it and the secularity aspect of it, but the position then of the religious minority with the swagger, let's say Muslims or Jews with Catholics, when it comes to the evangelical Christians,
yeah,
who feel like the emergence of this religious minority, yes, in America is forcing them to retrench,
yes,
instead of embrace secular,
yeah,
secularity three.
Yeah.
Can you talk about that?
So, yeah, it's interesting because we've also had Muslim students come to Calvin College, which is a Christian liberal arts college, precisely because they see it as an ethos that is more hospitable to how they would want to live out their faith than Michigan State or something like that, right? So, the analysis I want to give is of those evangelicals who are responding the way you do, the way you're noting. There's something going on there in which something other than their evangelical identity is trumping their political interests at that point. Do you know what I mean? Like, I want to say their religious identity is a stalking horse or code for something else, which again, to me, is why we need a diagnosis of how and why Protestant evangelicalism seemed so susceptible to being co-opted by forces other than it, and yet you could still wear it. Like, so to what extent can evangelicalism be something you wear to really cover your American nationalism or something like that? It seems very susceptible to that in the United States in the ways that it's not in other places. And so this is where you almost need now, we almost have to get down to the level of theological correction within the Christian community. This is why I keep bringing up catechesis. Like, do people really understand what they should be doing? Because I agree, actually Tom and I had a fascinating conversation last night where we were saying, what was the stat? 70% of Muslims voted for George W. Bush in the 2000 election? Precisely because of social values, right? Obviously that radically changes after 9/11. And yet, if I'm a Christian who's interested in public life and the common good, I see as some of my significant compatriots in that endeavor, Muslim and Jews, who actually share a lot of these concerns, right? And I feel like I have resources internal to the Christian tradition to narrate exactly why I ought to do that. I feel like I'm not answering your question, though. Does that help?
We're about to break for lunch, but James, you're okay? Okay, Claire Duffy, you're going to take us into lunch with a clear and concise question.
With a really short question, I promise. This is sort of random. When did the impression of libertinism attach to secularity? You said at one point cracks appeared in the libertinism.
Yeah.
When did that impression attach, and why?
We need dates.
So I may have spoken too hastily. I guess it depends on the story you want to tell about the 1960s. And I wasn't here, but allegedly. So maybe what we could say is at the heart of a secularist outlook, and therefore even a lot of secular spiritualities, is this valorization of autonomy as the ultimate good. I would say it's also woven into the American Declaration of Independence, but anyway, that's a different theme. So that then gets realized in different ways, and it seems to me that one of those is its realization in the sexual revolution of the 60s, which I just think we're already at an interesting phase in which, I don't know, I'm total square, I don't know how these things go, but I do feel like there's a certain reassessment of that going on. At least I'm of the generation of sort of kids whose parents were divorced multiple times over, and so we're asking ourselves questions about certain sexual mores that were taken for granted in John Updike novels that don't get replayed in the novels of David Foster Wallace. It's a fascinating, you know, it's just two totally different worlds, and that association of libertinism, I'm just tying to this trenchant fixation on autonomy as really the only good that could be affirmed, and wondering whether people are already feeling the effects of that. That said, I was married at 19, so who am I to say, right?
I'd like to give another commercial. If you want to get a less than 3-minute summary of the life and thought of St. Augustine, Google Jamie Smith and Augustine on YouTube. And Jamie, I guess it's in anticipation of this book, Jamie, isn't it?
Yeah, and another big book I'm working on.
What's that book called?
On the Road with Augustine, which is why I think Augustine is our great, this is somewhat ripping off David, but I think Augustine is the great postmodern saint, because he actually lived a certain kind of cross-pressure himself.
Yes.
He's, you know, we had the Wolf of Wall Street. Augustine was the Lupin de Milan. He was the Wolf of Milan. He lived Leo's life, but then sort of realized and found fullness and wholeness in a different story. So I'm playing on Kerouac's On the Road, and that's the next project.
And so the title again is?
On the Road with Augustine.
And when is that
But You
coming?
Are With You Love is also very much Augustinian in its spirit.
But when is that one coming?
Well, it still needs to be written. So 2018.
Oh, I see. Yeah, it hasn't been written yet. Okay.
No, no, no.
But if you would do a YouTube of Jamie and Augustine and Lady Lodge, that little 2 minutes and 40 seconds overview he gives of why Augustine's important today is really, really valuable. So we aim to promote our speakers, their books, and now their YouTubes, and their CDs, and their music, whatever. Ladies and gentlemen,
you're taking me back to my preacher days when the preacher brought tapes in the back. And
yes, exactly. Join me in thanking our speaker this
morning.
Thank
you very much.